U.S. says it's investigating allegations of human rights abuses by Israel.
We apply the same standard to everyone.
The first ever criminal trial of a former U.S. president gets underway.
Prosecutors said the former president broke the law and deceived voters in the 2016 election by trying to cover up sexual encounters with adult film actress Stormy Daniels.
And on Earth Day 2024, we'll take a tour of a zero-emissions ocean-going ship.
Energy Observer has been sailing around the world for the last 7 years without a drop of diesel or fuel.
Today is Tuesday, April 23rd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. The United States is looking into allegations of human rights abuses by Israel in its operations against Hamas in Gaza. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
Do we have a double standard? The answer is no. As this report makes clear, in general, as we're looking at human rights and the condition of human rights around the world, we apply the same standard to everyone. And that doesn't change whether the country in question is an adversary, a competitor, a friend, or an ally.
Axios News, the website, reported that Washington was planning to sanction an Israeli battalion, which is operated in the occupied West Bank. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he would fight against sanctions being imposed on any Israeli military units for alleged rights violations. Israel has yet to provide evidence for its accusation that hundreds of staff with the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, we often call it UNRWA, are members of terrorist groups. This is according to a review of the agency's neutrality, which was released on Monday, that could prompt some donors to review funding freezes. French Foreign Minister Catherine Colonna has led the review.
Overall, the findings of the review are that UNRWA has in place a very significant number of mechanisms and procedures to ensure compliance with the humanitarian principle of neutrality. Actually, they probably have a more developed system than other UN organizations or agencies, which is a necessity considering the very difficult environment, complex and difficult situation in which they operate, and the uniqueness of their mission.
In February, Israel alleged that 12 UNRWA staff took part in the Hamas-led October 7th attacks, which triggered the Gaza war. A separate investigation by UN investigators is looking into those allegations. A group of activists hopes to break Israel's blockade of Gaza with a flotilla of vessels carrying aid ready to set sail from Istanbul in the coming days. In a similar mission 14 years ago, Israeli forces intercepted a Turkish flotilla in a deadly raid that resulted in the deaths of 10 people. There are warnings that this attempt may trigger a new crisis. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The Akdeniz will lead the flotilla of three ships from Istanbul, carrying more than 5,000 metric tons of aid to Gaza, including medical supplies and food. The flotilla is organized by a coalition of international and Turkish humanitarian groups. They say it's not just about delivering aid, but challenging what they describe as Israel's blockade on Gaza. They want Israel to allow aid to enter from Egypt. Anne Wright is with a group called U.S. Boat to Gaza.
We hope to break the illegal naval blockade of Gaza that Israel has had on it for decades.
It's been 14 years since flotilla organizers last tried to break the blockade. Activists say they are aware of the dangers they face, but say the risk is worth taking. Nima Mashouf is with another one of the groups, Canada Boat to Gaza.
We are conscious that it's not a mission without any danger.
Everyone taking part is having lessons on how to de-escalate a possible confrontation with Israeli forces. There's been no comment from Israeli officials, but analysts warn the risks are real given the tensions in the region. The flotilla is awaiting permission from Turkish authorities to set sail. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has not mentioned the flotilla publicly, but officials say he discussed humanitarian aid when he met with the Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh on Saturday. Israel condemned that meeting. The flotilla organisers say they are looking for international protection. It's a voyage analysts warn could be fraught with danger for the activists and for the region. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
The Israeli-Palestinian issue is once again heated up on U.S. college campuses. Two people were seen being taken into police custody during a pro-Palestinian demonstration at Columbia University on Monday, hours after the school canceled in-person classes to, well, an attempt to de-escalate tensions on its New York campus, where police cracked down on a tent encampment just last week. Some students were shaken up by what the protesters were saying.
We have protesters here advocating for Hamas, advocating, they were just chanting, you know, we don't want no two-state, we want all of it, right? They want to destroy, attack Israel. And I guess technically you have freedom of speech, but I don't think on a private college campus you can call for killing and attacking Jews in a Jewish country and without saying that's hate speech and that's violating the codes of conduct of the campus. So I think it's really upsetting and disturbing.
This drew an almost immediate reaction from elected officials. Here's U.S. Congressman Mike Lawler from New York's 17th Congressional District.
Every single one of these college and university presidents who refuse to take action should immediately resign in disgrace, and if they don't resign, their asses should be thrown out.
There were more restrained voices. U.S. Congressman Daniel Sachs Goldman from New York's 10th Congressional District.
We have seen encouraging statements, we've seen encouraging actions, and we have been in communication. I think it is very easy and very politically expedient for people to just simply call for the resignation of anyone who does not do exactly right in every situation. That is not the way that we want to operate. We do not believe that the problem is with every single president. We believe it is a systemic problem that needs to have leadership and needs to have people working together, both elected representatives and members of the administrations of academic institutions, to combat what is this dramatic rise of anti-Semitism and a feeling of insecurity from Jews on campus.
In a statement on Monday, Columbia President Manoush Shafiq said the university was canceling in-person classes and again denounced anti-Semitic language, as well as intimidating and harassing behavior that she said had occurred on campus recently. The decision to cancel classes on the New York campus followed the arrest of more than 100 protesters, some of whom had set up dozens of tents in what the school said was an unauthorized demonstration that disrupted school activities. We're following these other stories from around the world. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken headed to China on April 24th for talks with senior officials in Shanghai and Beijing, scheduled to discuss a range of topics, including the crisis in the Middle East, Russia's war against Ukraine, Taiwan, the South China Sea, and human rights. Turkish President Erdogan arrived in Iraq Monday, his first official visit in more than 10 years, as his country seeks greater cooperation from Baghdad in the fight against a Kurdish militant group that has a foothold in northern Iraq. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations has been viewed by the international community as the ideal political bloc to negotiate a resolution to the conflict in Myanmar, since its military ousted an elected government in 2021 and sparked a civil war. But the five-point consensus on ending the Myanmar crisis has been discredited by analysts and anti-regime forces who argue the 10-nation bloc has quietly backed the junta and ignored all other parties in the conflict. In our continuing coverage of the U.S. presidential election, marijuana is a rare consensus issue in politically divided America, with polls showing that 88% of Americans support at least partially legalizing the drug. But cannabis advocates say neither of the leading presidential candidates are capitalizing on these shifting attitudes. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Nearly three-quarters of Americans live in states where marijuana is legal for medicinal purposes. Half the population live where it's also allowed recreationally. But cannabis remains entirely illegal under federal law, where it's classified alongside heroin and LSD as drugs with no currently accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. The overwhelming majority of American voters who think that should be changed makes cannabis a ripe opportunity for presidential candidates Joe Biden and Donald Trump, especially among young voters, according to Scotty Smart, who's a community organizer with the civic engagement group, the New Georgia Project.
A lot of people don't understand policy. A lot of people don't know how policies affect their day-to-day lives. I think cannabis is an issue that ignites and excites young people to pay attention.
At the National Cannabis Festival and Washington Policy Summit earlier this month, founder Caroline Phillips said neither Biden nor Trump have delivered.
For both of them, one thing they have in common is that their track records on cannabis have been inconsistent and incremental. We've heard promises from both administrations, neither of which have panned out in full.
Under Biden, the Department of Health and Human Services recommended changing marijuana to a lighter drug classification, rescheduling it instead of making it legal, which would be descheduling.
The current White House's policy on marijuana remains slightly unclear. They have given us great signals that they're willing to shift towards descheduling, but most likely rescheduling. However, we haven't quite seen the action to back up their words.
In 2018, then-President Trump said he would, quote, probably support efforts to end federal prohibitions on marijuana and leave its legality up to the states. That legislation never got out of Congress. Trump told a Newsmax TV interviewer last year that studies show marijuana, quote, does significant damage, and yet, from a voting standpoint, it's a pretty popular thing.
Trump's track record on cannabis has been inconsistent at best. We've heard him both say that people who sell drugs in the illicit market should be jailed and even put to death, I think with some of the scarier rhetoric around that. But we've also seen him pardon people who've been locked up for cannabis.
U.S. voters' shifting attitudes about marijuana show in Gallup polling, where last year, 70% of adults supported legalization. That's more than double the number who said they favored legalization in 2000. Morgan Fox is political director for the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
This is an issue that is increasingly important to voters, particularly young voters. And any candidate that actually wants to get ahead, whether it's in the presidential election, in Congress, or state legislatures or local legislators, if they ignore this issue, it's going to be at their peril.
Younger voters animated by legalizing marijuana are hoping for Biden administration action on cannabis before the November election. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Day one of Donald Trump's criminal hush money trial in New York City. A wrap of the day's events from Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner.
Prosecutors said the former president broke the law and deceived voters in the 2016 election by trying to cover up sexual encounters with adult film actress Stormy Daniels and Playboy model Karen McDougal. Trump's defense attorney told the jury that his client committed no crime, adding, quote, "There's nothing wrong with trying to influence an election. It's called democracy." Trump is charged with falsifying business records to cover up a $130,000 payment to Daniels in 2016 to keep quiet about a sexual encounter she says they had 10 years earlier. Trump has pleaded not guilty and denies the encounter took place. Prosecutors said on Monday that Trump disguised payments to his personal lawyer Michael Cohen as legal services, when in fact they were meant to reimburse him for paying off Daniels.
Cohen is a lawyer, represented a lot of people over the years. Now, I'm not the only one. That check's being paid to a lawyer. He is a lawyer, or was a lawyer. And also the things he got in trouble for were things that had nothing to do with me.
Jurors also heard briefly from the prosecution's first witness, former National Enquirer publisher David Pecker, who prosecutors say participated in a catch-and-kill scheme to suppress unflattering stories about Trump and help him get elected. He is expected to return for more questioning Tuesday. The hush money case may be the only one of Trump's four criminal prosecutions to go to trial before the November 5th election. A guilty verdict would not bar him from taking office, but it could hurt his candidacy, as Reuters Ipsos polling shows half of independent voters and 1 in 4 Republicans say they would not vote for Trump if he is convicted of a crime.
Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. The U.S. military aid package for Ukraine, expected to finally pass this week, is a potential game changer. But Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony says that battlefield impact could take some time, with Russian troops still far outnumbering Ukraine's.
Острел!
Ukraine's exhausted artillery gunners holding off Russian forces near the eastern town of Kupiansk are hoping for a lifeline. The latest US aid package could be it, a potential game changer for Kyiv's forces. But it could take some time. One soldier, whose call sign is Sailor, says a shortage of shells has reduced Ukraine's covering fire for its infantrymen, costing lives and territory.
If they had passed the aid package bill earlier, we would have lost a bit less ground. We could have maybe taken back some ground.
The $61 billion aid package comes after 6 months of congressional wrangling. It could replenish Kyiv's critically low stocks of weaponry and air defenses, and likely improve its chances of averting a major Russian breakthrough in the east.
One voting present.
It's better now if we let them attack and we defend. But when the package will be a done deal, and we get the shells, drones and whatever else, then we do a 180-degree turn, gather our reserve forces and attack. We'll have our aviation with us, as it will be effective.
Kyiv still faces manpower shortages on the battlefield and questions about the strength of its sprawling frontline ahead of a potential Russian summer offensive. After months of political debates, a new, faster mobilization law takes effect in May. But new civilian draftees will require months of training, which some analysts say could become a window of opportunity for Russia to exploit. Russia has been slowly advancing, with its superior troop numbers and artillery, since capturing Avdiivka in February, a longtime bastion town in the eastern Donbass region. They are now bearing down on the town of Shasiv Yar, which is located on high ground. If captured, that win would bring Moscow closer to the remaining Kyiv-held Donbass cities of Konstantinivka, Kramatorsk and Slovyansk. President Volodymyr Zelensky says Russian forces are able to fire 10 times more artillery rounds than Ukraine's troops. One of his generals estimates Russian forces outnumber Kyiv's troops by as much as 10 times in the east. Ukrainian positions have been pounded this year thanks to Russian air superiority and Ukraine's dwindling defenses. One former Ukrainian defense minister said US-produced F-16 fighter jets, which Kyiv expects to receive later this year, would force Russian warplanes back entirely. EU assistance from June will include a Czech-led initiative to supply some 300,000 rounds of artillery shells. A senior European security source told Reuters optimistically that if Ukraine receives the new international assistance, the chances of averting a major Russian breakthrough over the next year are quite high.
Reuters correspondent Lauren Anthony. And finally, Monday was Earth Day, and the occasion let us look at the next generation of zero-emissions sailing ship. The Energy Observer docked in New York City to show off what its team hopes is the next generation of Earth-friendly boats. Elena Wolf got the story, narrated by Anna Rice.
It's called the Energy Observer, and its creators say it is the world's first self-sufficient zero-emissions vessel. Its mission? To test new low-carbon energy production technologies. The boat was recently in New York City. Its captain, Jean-Baptiste Sanchez, says sailing Energy Observer is a unique experience.
You feel good because, you know, you don't have any impact on the nature.
Energy Observer has been sailing around the world for the last 7 years and covered nearly 65,000 nautical miles without a drop of diesel or fuel. The boat is covered with more than 200 square meters of solar cells, and the rest is wind and water.
So here we are in front of one of our two ocean wings. This is sails, but automated.
Energy Observer has seen its share of cloudy days, and when there's no sun, the boat relies on hydrogen fuel cells.
It's like a generator, but instead of diesel, it will use hydrogen. Mm-hmm. Hydrogen, it'll take the water from the air, the oxygen from the air and the hydrogen that we provide, and it will do the reverse operation than the electrolysis. Which means that from hydrogen and oxygen, we'll have electricity and water and warm water and also heat. And so the electricity will use it to charge the batteries and life on board.
The vessel sailed from Norwegian Spitsbergen to tropical Hawaii, making some 50 stops along the course of its journey. While in New York, Energy Observer received a UN certificate on Earth Day for its contributions to protecting the planet.
Our first mission, yeah, is completed in the sense that we have tested and proved what we wanted to do. But of course, like the raising awareness never ends, so we will keep on doing it, and we will move to a larger scale, building the lowest carbon cargo ships. So it's going to be a new project.
The ship's next stop is Boston, and then, sometime after the Paris Olympics this summer, retirement, as the scientists move on to the next project. For Elena Wolf in New York, NRI's VOA News.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States has reimposed oil and gas sanctions on Venezuela after President Nicolas Maduro reneged on his commitments to follow an election roadmap that offered a chance for the Venezuelan people to return to democratic governance. In October 2023, under the Barbados Agreement, Maduro and representatives of Venezuelan opposition parties pledged to work toward free and fair elections in the second half of 2024. Maduro promised to establish a timetable for the election and to allow members of the opposition to run for office without arbitrary restrictions. Although a date for the election has been set, July 28th, many more of the provisions of the Barbados Agreement remain unfulfilled. The Maduro government has arrested members of the Democratic opposition and barred candidates from running, including Maduro's most popular competitor for the presidency, Maria Corina Machado. In addition, Maduro has arbitrarily detained and violated the due process rights of many individuals critical of his government, including members of the Democratic opposition, civil society, former members of the military, and journalists. In a statement announcing the U.S. decision to reimpose sanctions by allowing General License 44 to expire on April 18th, the State Department said, despite delivering on some of the commitments made under the Barbados electoral roadmap, we are concerned that Maduro and his representatives prevented the Democratic opposition from registering the candidate of their choice, harassed and intimidated political opponents, and unjustly detained numerous political actors and members of civil society. We again call on Maduro to allow all candidates and parties to participate in the electoral process and release all political prisoners without restrictions or delay. Principal Deputy Spokesperson Vidant Patel told reporters the full implementation of the Barbados Agreement offers the best path to restore democracy that Venezuelans deserve.
We think it'll help improve economic and humanitarian conditions and also address the migration crisis. We're going to continue to support Venezuelans' aspirations for a more democratic, stable, and prosperous Venezuela while remaining fully committed to working with all parties interested in competitive elections.
Spokesperson Patel declared the United States will coordinate with regional and international partners in support of this Barbados Agreement that we continue to think is key to get Venezuela on a democratic, stable, and prosperous path.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.